Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat. I am honored today to be in dialogue with my guest, Dr. Racheli Haliva. She is a junior professor at the Institute for Jewish Philosophy and Religion and one of the co-directors of the Maimonides Center for Advanced Studies, Jewish Skepticism at Universität Hamburg, the University of Hamburg. We are here today to discuss her book, Isaac Pulkar, A Jewish Philosopher or a Philosopher and a Jew, Philosophy and Religion in Isaac Pulkar's Ezer Hadat and Teshuvat Apikoros, published in Berlin by De Gruyter, 2020. Racheli, it's an honor to be in dialogue with you today.
Thank you, Ari. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
Thank you. Please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? Can you share with us something about your family and your upbringing?
I grew up in Dimona, which is a very small city in the south of Israel, like 30 kilometers south to Be'er Sheva. After my service in the army, I went to study my BA and my MA at the Hebrew University, after which I moved to Canada, to Montreal, and completed my PhD in 2015 at McGill University in the Institute for Jewish Studies and Philosophy, but it was sort of a combination between Jewish studies, philosophy, and Islamic studies. And since December 2015, I'm here in Hamburg, as you said. I'm a junior professor here, so I have some students here, many undergrad, but also I'm responsible for the MA program. And in between those, I'm also part of this family that is called Maimonides Center for Advanced Studies, where we have a fellowship program, organizing many events, and collaborating with the Jewish community here in Hamburg. So that's in a nutshell who I am.
Wonderful. How did you become interested in studying medieval Jewish thought and philosophy?
So when I came to the Hebrew University, I started my BA in international relations and archaeology. And at one point I realized that that's not really my field that I want to pursue. So I entered a class by Professor Avi Ravitsky, who gave the introduction to medieval Jewish philosophy and thought. And I felt like home. So I switched my major, my minor to Jewish thought, like Machshavat Yisrael, and philosophy. And I'm there since then. So it was a wonderful place during the 2000s to learn at the Hebrew U with all the great minds, such as Professor Harvey, Professor Moshe Idel, Israel Knoll, Meir Buzaglo, Katerina Rigo, who was my MA advisor, and Moshe Halbertal, and many others. So this is how I became like part of this medieval Jewish philosophy and thought family.
Wow, what an impressive list of teachers you've had. I'm in awe of the people that you have worked with and gotten to know personally. You're so blessed to have known such people and learned from such people. What inspired you to write this book? What drew you to Yitzhak Pulkar's writing in particular?
Right. So when I came to McGill, so I already came with some sort of idea, general idea, what I wanted to do in my PhD. And it was a post-Maimonidean thought. So, you know, many people are dealing with Maimonides, writing about Maimonides, whether they like it, whether they don't like it. And for me, it was more interesting to see how people reacted to Maimonides, more precisely how people deviated themselves from Maimonides. And the options were very limited. So it was either Kaspi or Narboni or Albalag or Pulkar. But what drew me to Pulkar was, I guess, his connection to Abner of Burgos, the convert, according to Yitzhak Be'er, the most dangerous convert in Jewish history. And the connection between the theological part and the philosophical part is what drew me to personally to Yitzhak Pulkar. At the beginning, I had no idea where I'm going to end with his thought, but I'm very happy that I did. I found a very original and profound thinker who was radical in many times, but yet respectful. So this is how I came to start to study his thought and his surroundings, especially the Christian or the converts, more precisely.
Speaking of Abner of Burgos, who was he? Can you contextualize him for us? Can you describe him for our listeners who might not be familiar?
Yeah. So Abner of Burgos, actually, he was Pulkar's teacher, as he attests in one of the letters. He tells Pulkar, I remember you were so wise when you were in Beit Midrashi, in my school. So he was his teacher. So he was a rabbi, like before his conversion, he was a rabbi, and who lived in the 13th century. And when he was 62 or 63, he testified that he had a long struggle between Judaism and Christianity. The struggle took like years. And after these years of struggle, he decided to convert to Christianity. And I can only imagine what it did to people like Pulkar, who were his students and who really looked up to Abner, their really admired rabbi who decides to leave Judaism. And not only to leave Judaism, it's okay, you know, if you want to convert to Christianity for whatever reason. But the problem is that Abner not only converted to Christianity, but he did everything in his power to convince as many Jews as possible to convert as well. So for that, he didn't write in Spanish. I mean, he had one translation of his own work, Moreh Tzedek. So he wrote the work in Hebrew, but then he translated himself to Spanish. But most of his work is written in Hebrew. Most of his work contain mainly Jewish sources to be familiar to the Jewish ear. So that's why I guess Yitzhak Be'er is writing that he's the most dangerous one. Pulkar himself accuses Abner of converting to Christianity for for convenient reasons. So it would be more convenient to be a Christian in that period of time in northern Spain than to be a persecuted Jew. So he's really accusing him of seeking a better and easy life. The same goes for Narbonne, who writes against Abner in the issue of Chofesh Ratzon, of the freedom of the will, because this is how Abner is perceiving himself as a determinist. He had no choice but to convert to Christianity. So Narbonne is attacking him on that point.
In your study, you devote significant attention to Pulkar's critique of Christianity. Can you comment on the relevance of this critique for our time? What is Pulkar's place and in debates about Jewish-Christian relations, whether the history of Jewish-Christian relations? Can you speak about the grounds on which he critiqued Christianity?
Right. So I guess his critique didn't start against Christianity per se, but as the converts, right? So
right.
He's first and foremost attack the converts. But he, like Maimonides, like others, they have a big problem with the Christian doctrines as a strict Averroist or Maimonidean in that sense. They are defending the idea of monotheism, and more importantly, that God has no human attributes of any sort. And Christianity poses a very big problem to a Jew or to a Muslim at that time to think about Jesus as a God or the incarnation or the Trinity that damages the whole idea of unity. So he has a problem theologically and philosophically with Christianity, and I think it would be valid again now because the doctrines are not different, they're pretty much the same. But in terms of the political aspect, I don't think he had any problem. I mean, as long as Christians would live an ethical life, he had no problem them being Christians. The problem is the persecution and oppression. And the political becomes relevant when he attacks on theological and political ground.
How should we understand the difference between Averroism and Maimonideanism in medieval Jewish philosophy? Are the two terms interchangeable? Why or why not? How should we differentiate between them? Why do you emphasize Jewish Averroism and Averroists as opposed to Maimonideanism and Maimonideanists?
Right. It's a good question. So, as you know, Maimonides and Averroes were contemporaries, more or less. And the reason why I call those people, at least my Pulkar and Al-Balagh, Averroes, as opposed to, let's say, Caspi, who were Maimonidean, is the way they are addressing main philosophical issues. So I'll give an example. So if, for instance, we take the idea of the creation, or let's say a cosmogony. So until today, people are debating what is Maimonides' genuine opinion, right? So some would side with the idea that the world is created ex nihilo, from the absolute non-existent. But others, like Professor Harvey, for instance, he thinks that Maimonides was pretty Aristotelian, siding with the eternity of the world. Now, this crucial questions was very vague in the Guide of the Perplexed. You cannot really find a clear answer. What is Maimonides' opinion? It cannot be like as clear as other topics. So at one point he says, you know, because it's not a demonstrative proof that the world is created ex nihilo either, it is eternal. Therefore, I would go with the prophets and I will hold the belief of our Torah that the world was created ex nihilo. And people like Al-Balagh and Pulkar completely rejected that because they came after Averroes, after the commentary of Averroes on Aristotle's work on the physics and the metaphysics, the anima, etc. And they already have what they call a demonstrative proof that the world is nitzchi, it's eternal in a way. So in that sense, in those kind of crucial questions, they're siding with Ibn Rushd, with Averroes, and not with Maimonides. The same thing goes, for instance, about their idea of the commandments, for example. Maimonides was very eager to explain the commandments and their meaning. He devotes like 26 chapters of the guide to explain those. While Al-Balagh and Polkar, it was quite clear that, yeah, it is important to observe the commandments, but to a certain limits, because there are more important commandments than the other. So if you deal with philosophy, which is the most important commandment, it's way more important if you pray three times a day or if you keep kosher. Those are only a means to an end. So in that sense, I call him and Al-Balagh Averroes, because they're not really, they're not afraid to adopt Averroes' point of view. Caspi is more careful. Caspi is really defending Maimonides with everything he got. Even if he has some sort of criticism, it's very difficult to understand that he's really criticizing. The other two, or even in some cases Narboni, what they try to do in many cases is to interpret Maimonides in light of Averroes' philosophy, to say that was what Maimonides really meant, even though, you know, it's a stretch, but that's what they do. And in other cases, like Al-Balagh, who is really a radical one, he is criticizing Maimonides with everything he's got, to the point where he says, you know, the Guide of the Perplexed was written for the Hamon, for the masses, for the multitude. My book, you know, Tikkun HaDe'ot, is for the philosophers. So I don't know anyone from the post-Maimonidean thought who would be so direct in his criticism against Maimonides. But he would never say that about Averroes.
Yes. In your conclusion, you relate Pulcar to Spinoza, noting that Jewish Averroists critique Maimonides parallels Spinoza's. Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah. So we don't have a clear evidence whether Spinoza read Pulcar or Caspi, but we do know that he read Crescas, Hasdai Crescas, for instance. We do know that he was aware of Orashem of Crescas. And Crescas was greatly influenced by Avner of Burgos, especially when it comes to determinism and the free will discussion. So it's not inevitable. Already Shlomo Pinas noted a few ideas connecting Polkar and Spinoza. But I found like a very interesting discussion that might, through some channels, reach Spinoza from Polkar, and that's his theory of prophecy. So prophecy, according to Maimonides and also Averroes and Ibn Sina and other post-Maimonidean thinkers, are that the prophet is first and foremost a great philosopher. He has to be a great philosopher. He has to have ethical virtues, and he has to have a very good power of imagination, right? That's what makes a prophet a prophet. And Polkar is completely against this idea. So he says in the third part of the Ezeradat, he says that the prophet only gets the emanation from the divine onto his power of imagination. It has nothing to do with intellectual power. And if you go to the TTP, the Tractatus, the tractate, the theological political tractate by Spinoza, the first two chapters, that's exactly what he says there. Prophecy and prophet, he says, the only thing that the prophet has is a vivid imagination. It has nothing to do with his intellectual power. So this, I mean, it's very difficult for me to see, to not to see the connection between it. But even though I don't have really the clear evidence that he actually read Ezerodan, or whether he got to this idea through other channels with Abner, Crescas, and then until the 17th century Spinoza.
Can you elaborate on Pulcar's understanding of prophecy? What does this say about his understanding of epistemology and of politics? How does Pulcar's understanding of prophecy differ from Maimonides and Avicenna?
Yeah, well, according to Avicenna, there are basically two levels of prophecy, right? You have the emanation from the active intellect emanating on the what he called the undeveloped or unmature intellect, and then he somehow gets everything through, in Arabic it's called the hads, so it's sort of an intuition. He gets everything, but it's undeveloped. So this is the lower level. And the higher level is when this person is mature, meaning that he really prepared himself in time, in terms of time and study to receive this emanation. And Maimonides is quite influenced by that. For Maimonides, we have to remember that the ultimate man of all is, of course, Moses. And what makes Moses the most perfect human is both being a great philosopher and being a great prophet. So that means that according to Maimonides, when you talk about a prophet, you cannot separate prophecy from philosophy. Every prophet is necessarily a philosopher. Moses is necessarily a perfect philosopher. The emanation that he gets overflows onto his intellectual power and his power of imagination. And Pulcar is really he doesn't accept this Maimonidean view, and this is one of the cases that he completely criticized Maimonides. He describes the process of prophecy as if the emanation, let's say, emanates directly to the power of imagination, this person is called Navi or Jose, you know, a prophet or Jose, whatever you want to translate that. And if the emanation emanates from the active intellect onto the person's intellectual power, then he is what he calls Ha'adam HaShalem, the perfect man. So for him, if according to Maimonides, the prophet is the peak of humanity, according to Pulcar, the philosopher is the peak of humanity. There is another aspect to it in terms of education. A prophet cannot educate other people. He only gets his own personal experience. He cannot teach anyone. So even if he has this kind of inspiration, this huds, this intuition, he cannot really teach to other. And for Pulcar, the idea of education is extremely important. The philosopher can lead you from one point to another by teaching you, because he's doing the correct process of understanding by learning, and not by just, you know, an instant inspiration.
What does it mean to you to study Rabbi Pulcar as a female? What unique insights do you bring to medieval Jewish philosophy by studying it as a woman? In light of what you just alluded to, his idea of the perfect man, would his idea of the perfect man include women? Could a female achieve the status of a perfect man according to Pulcar? What is your perspective on that?
It's not really my perspective. It's his own perspective. He was a person of his time, you know, and nobody were women advocates at that time. I cannot really point to anyone who was feminist at that time. I tried to study him as a philosopher, what it means for me as a female. Not so much. I mean, if I had to exclude medieval philosophers who were against women, I wouldn't study any of them, as you may know. But, you know, I try to judge his work based on the time that he lived in and not based on his judgment against what he calls the fool, the women, and the kids, you know, not very different than Maimonides in a way.
Would Pulcar's critique of Kabbalah, as it appears in his book, Ezer Haddad, have extended to Sufism as well? Likewise, would Pulcar's critique of Al-Ghazali's Incoherence of the Philosophers, based on Averroes' critique, have extended to Sufism more broadly? Why or why not? Was it?
We don't have any evidence. I mean, the whole connection between Pulcar and Abner and their debate to Kabbalah is debatable in itself. So there is one scholar, Shoshana Gershenzon, who actually sees the connection between Abner and his debate with Pulcar and Kabbalah. I have to say that I didn't find any evidence to that. It was quite parallel when Sefer HaZohar was discovered / written in the 13th century. So I don't see any clear connection to Kabbalah. As for the connection to Sufism, so he doesn't have a clear discussion about Sufism, but based on what he says on personal experience and how men should reach the ultimate goal, he would be against Sufism, because Sufism, he was the first opponent of Ghazali. He says that quite clear. But generally to Sufism, the whole idea of personal experience, in a sense that you cannot, again, we're going back to the education part, that you cannot really teach others about this personal experience is problematic. So again, I would stress that there is no clear discussion about that, but based on other theories that he discussed in the letter and the in Ezer Haddad, he would be completely against any kind of Sufism.
What contribution does Pulcar make to epistemology? How does Pulcar understand the nature of knowledge?
It's not different than the way Averroes and Maimonides thought. So for him, it's quite clear how you get a true knowledge. Yeah, how he was anti-skeptic in that sense. He does think that you are able to reach true knowledge if you do all the stages. So if you study what Maimonides already said, that you have to first study logic and then mathematics and then physics and then astronomy, and only then you reach to metaphysics. So when it comes to epistemological knowledge of the physics, he has no problem with that. So you can reach, there is absolutely no problem of reaching a true knowledge. And again, he belongs to this school of Caspi, Falakera, Narboni, etc., that are anti-skeptic in that sense. When it comes to metaphysics, then things are becoming more problematic, yeah, because then you have to talk about the nature of God, whether or not you're able to say something about the essence of God, and it's a very complicated issue, especially after Maimonides' theory of the via negativa, that you cannot say anything positive, you cannot give any positive attribution to God, and the only way is to do a negative. So Pogel doesn't continue with this via negativa issue, but he does claim that you are able to reach some sort of metaphysical knowledge in that sense. Still, I mean, again, it doesn't have a very clear discussion like Maimonides does in the Guide of the Perplexed about the limitation of the human knowledge, but it would be very reasonable to assume that even for him, as an anti-skeptic in a way, there would be a limit. So you won't be able to fully understand the separate intellect, and certainly you won't be able to fully understand the first cause, whether it's God or not.
A significant portion of your book is devoted to Pulkar's understanding of Tzaddik Viralo. How does Pulkar understand theodicy? Can you elaborate for us?
So this is a significant part of my book because it was extremely important to Pulkar. It was part of his debate with Abner, the determinist, who denies any free will. So Tzaddik Viralo, Rasha V'Tovlo, the whole theodicy, it is brought in the Ezer Adat in order to claim that there is a free will as opposed to what Abner says. So what he basically says is the following. There are three types of events, in the world that we can categorize them. So the first one would be what he called the tivim, the natural one. The second one would be the mikrim, the accidental one. And the third one would be retzonim, the voluntary one. So the first two types of events, and these events also include whatever is happening to human, he claims that human being has no influence about that, right? So if we know that next week there's going to be an eclipse or there's going to be a snow, there's absolutely no way we can prevent that or do anything to change that. The same thing goes with the accident. If something goes by accident, let's say, if a natural disaster happens and one stone is fallen on someone's head, so he would call it as an accident, not as a natural, but again, human beings cannot prevent that or change the course of the stone. And then the third one, which is the most important one, the voluntary one, he says that God or the first cause in the first place eliminated himself from not being attached to this kind of events. Because if he would have been attached to this kind of events, then it would have limited him. It would put him in some sort of limitation. So the fact, so God doesn't know, literally God doesn't know what we do, except that when we're actually doing that, and then because he's the first cause, so of course he's the first cause of everything, but the part where someone is making a choice, whether A or B, God himself doesn't know. Not because he's limited, but because he's omniscient and omnipotent. That precisely attests to his omnipotence. Does it make sense to you?
Yes, thank you. How is this understanding of theodicy or of Tzaddik Viralo similar or different from Pulkar's contemporaries among Maimonideans and Averroists in the Jewish world? Do they think similarly about Tzaddik Viralo, or is there something different in the nuance that Pulkar applies to the question of theodicy?
Right. So maybe to connect to the previous question. So the whole question of Tzaddik Viralo, I think Pulkar is not different so much from Maimonides. So as long as you are occupied yourself with the study of philosophy, of sciences, the more you occupy yourself, the more you're protected, right? The more you're governed, and the less harm come to you. But since we're all human beings in a body, so we cannot be engaged in philosophy 24/7. So in those instances that you're not engaged in philosophy, then the harm can come to you. So in that sense, he's not so different from Maimonides. As for contemporary, I'm not quite sure who I can say who is the contemporary Maimonidean or Averroist. I suppose it's, I mean, if you judge this kind of theories from 21st century, it would seem a bit weird, right? I mean, it would seem really weird that if you are in a laboratory and investigating any kind of, I don't know, mathematical problem or physical problem, so the idea that no harm can come to you, it seems a bit weird in our eyes. But to certainly to Maimonides and to Polka and to other post-Maimonidean thinkers, they really thought that the more you are in philosophy, in science, so you understand the world better. And if you understand the world better, it means that you can avoid those damages or those calamities. And one aspect of it, actually, it's one of the most interesting theory that he has is the exile, right? So of course we're talking about Jews in exile, very difficult time for them. So for him, I mean, he would say probably, you know, the exile came upon the Jews not because maybe I should give like the background on this. So you have more or less, until Polkar, you have three opinions why the exile happened, right? So you have the Orthodox Jews who say the exile came because we were sinned, we abandoned God, and therefore we are punished. Okay, this is very Orthodox. We have the Christian idea that says, you know, you didn't accept Jesus, you didn't accept him as the Messiah, therefore you are punished. Another way they're punished. And then Maimonides comes and brings another natural idea, right? In the letter to the sages of Montpellier. So he argues there that the exile came because our fathers, that's what he writes, avoteinu chatku, our father made a sin. They did not occupy themselves with occupying lands and protecting the land because they were too busy with stargazing, yeah, with astrology. So because they focused on astrology, they did not do what they were supposed to do to protect the land. Therefore, we were exiled because, you know, the nations kicked us out from the land of Israel, and then we are where we are. And then Polka comes and he says, absolutely not. We were exiled because we followed the law, because we had the commandments, because we had an ethical code. And since you have an ethical code, it literally means that you are weaker because you don't have weapon, you don't fight. So because you were following the law and other nations did not have an ethical law, then they were able to persecute you. That means that, you know, he somehow, you know, contradicts himself. So if on the one hand you're saying that we were exiled and punished because you were keeping and observing the commandment, so that means that you're also occupying yourself with philosophical and scientific knowledge. But on the other hand, you are punished. So, and you're exiled. So where, I mean, the theodicy here is a little bit problematic. So yeah, I mean, I don't think he's too far from Maimonides in terms of theodicy, but at the same time, he's also deviating a little bit from Maimonides' idea of theodicy.
What might Polkar and those who thought similarly to him in his period say to those who are unable, by virtue of circumstances beyond their control, who are unable to obtain expertise in the theoretical sciences. For example, what might he say to those who, because of barriers of class, economics, privilege, gender, mental health, or race, are unable to acquire the expertise in the theoretical and physical sciences? Are they relegated to quote unquote ignorance and vulgarity and to be part of the multitude forever? And in fact, even within the academic world as we experience it in our time in the year 2022, even within the sciences, the divisions between disciplines and the silo effect between scholars who isolate themselves into specific specializations prevents people from mastering multiple fields and multiple subfields. Hence, the organization of science in our day, even if we avoid thinking about the economics or political economy of science in our day, is very different than in a medieval context when the sum total knowledge of what was considered science was more limited. I'm curious, how do we reevaluate Pulkar and those who thought similarly to him in light of the significant barriers that exist in our own day when scientific knowledge is more available, but also there are greater barriers to access it than in other times? How might we think of him in this context and those who thought like him?
Right. I don't think he's different than this circle of Maimonides, Ibn Tibbon. There certainly were an elitist in that sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by elitist, I mean not only the person who has barrier of, let's say, wealth, health, etc. Even if you have all those preconditions, that you're healthy in your body and mind, that you were coming from a well-established family, etc., you still need to have the capacity and the ability to reach those levels of philosophical knowledge. The fact that you have all those preconditions does not guarantee that you will get there, certainly. But I do think that Pulkar has some sort of sense of responsibility. So even if you are, for whatever reason, cannot reach those kind of levels, you're still part of the community, and this community is supposed to protect you as such. So he wouldn't say that, you know, like we say today, everybody is born equal. He would certainly not say that. Everybody is not born equal until according to his view. But even if people are not born equal, they're still deserve to be protected. They still deserve to be part of the community. They still deserve to at least study or be educated, for instance, in the main things, like the fact that people are educated to say the Shema all the time, to indicate that God is one, that he's incorporeal. He understands that they don't fully understand what it means that God is one, that God is incorporeal. But at least, you know, the education for them gives them the opportunity to be part of this discourse in that sense. So elitist, yes, but I wouldn't say he's like completely, he would call them ignorant, but they would deserve this kind of protection and guidance, as long as, you know, the rabbis will allow this sort of philosopher king to be part of this community and to lead that.
Yes. How would Pulkar have been introduced to Averroes' writings in the first place? How would he have come to interact with Ibn Rushd's ideas personally, educationally, like sociologically? How would he have accessed these ideas to begin with?
So, first of all, we know that Pulkar read Arabic. He knew Arabic, even though he lived in Castilla at that time, in northern Spain. And the reason that we know that he knew Arabic is that Al-Balagh's book, Tikkun ad-Daud, so Al-Balagh is translating the Maqasid, the Al-Ghazali's work, but he didn't finish the translation. And Polkar was the one who finished the translation. So we know he knew Arabic. At that time, the writing of Averroes were quite, they were quite widespread. So he had no problem of reaching the Arabic original text. Some of them he knew through a second literature, yeah, like Al-Balagh himself was one of his sources. But he himself cites the tahafut, al-tahafut, the incoherence of the incoherence. So we know that at least he had some access to Averroes, to the Averroes books in Arabic. So that wouldn't be a problem.
What does it say about the nature and character of Jewish religion that its engagement with Greek philosophy arguably took place relatively late compared to its rival religions, such as Christianity, for example, which was engaging with Aristotle and Plato ever since the church fathers, centuries before Maimonides and his followers were on the scene? And likewise, whether it's Polkar engaging with Averroes or Maimonides engaging with Islamic thinkers, they are engaging with thinkers who were engaging with Jewish, with Greek philosophy before Jews were, arguably. And I'm just curious, what does it say about the nature and character of Jewish religion that we engage with these thinkers relatively late relative to Christianity's engagement with these thinkers or even Islam's?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true. I mean, I think the first Jewish comprehensive work that was engaged with the Greek philosophy was Philo, of course, Philo of Alexandria. Yes. And of course, in the Middle Ages, it was thanks to the project of translation from Greek into Arabic in the 9th century onwards that they were just, you know, the scribes and the translator just brought every work in Greek philosophy, Plato and Aristotle in particular, into the world. So of course there was a really a revival at that time simply because Jews, they didn't read Greek but they read Arabic, and this project of translating came in full force. So yeah, it came late. And Polkar and Maimonides himself and the rest of this group, they were familiar with those Arabic translations that made it possible for them to know Aristotle, to the point where, you know, when you read, for instance, Averroes' commentary on Aristotle, it's very difficult in many times to separate what Aristotle actually said and what Averroes said. So people just immediately think that it's all Aristotle, but actually it's not, because many of it, it's Averroes' already commentary. So when Jews used to quote or cite or like bring Aristotle, in many cases they brought Averroes as Aristotle. So you have to go back to Aristotle to see what he says, and then to see what Averroes somehow in an integral way put Aristotle into his ideas, or his ideas into Aristotle. So yeah, I mean, it's relatively late, but better late than never, I guess.
If Jewish Averroism was more mainstream in contemporary Jewish religious life than it is, what would be different about the Jewish religious community today? We tend to think of study Jewish Averroism and Maimonides and his successors and those who debated with him in academic circles, in Jewish studies departments, in Jewish thought and philosophy departments. People like us are interested in Jewish Averroism and the response to Maimonides. If these ideas were more mainstream and more popular and presented in synagogues and such, what would be different about the culture of religious Jewish life in our time?
I guess, I mean, if there would be this freedom of ideas, freedom of thought, I guess there would be more tolerance as far as I can see that. So this become really relevant, like when Spinoza is doing that, right? He says, I have no problem with the way you you're being a religious of any kind, as long as you give freedom of idea, freedom of thought. And I can hardly even imagine that what would happen if you go to Mea Shearim and you said, okay, so you know what, let's now read Jewish Averroists or even Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed. I can only assume that you won't be able to leave this shul in one piece, because in many cases they see it as a threat, you know. I mean, first and foremost, because you're bringing a foreign ideas into Judaism. Second of all, you are daring to discuss things like the commandments, which are, for them, it's a divine decree. It's not something to be discussed. So I can only assume that if there will be some sort of a transformation in their in the way they think, it would promote primarily the tolerance between the many streams within Judaism, because it will allow freedom of thought. But when it comes to praxis, you can do whatever you want in your own home, as long as you're not imposing anyone else. But that would be, you know, in Yemot HaMashiach, if at all. I'm not sure.
Thank you. Hopefully, thank you. as we bring this dialogue to a close, what are you working on now as your subsequent project?
So it's different, but it's also connected to what I did. So I'm working in the past year and a half, 2 years, about conversion in the Middle Ages, or so 13th, 14th, and 15th century. Not from a philosophical point of view, maybe a little bit from philosophical point of view, but also from a political, but mainly a theological point of view. So I'm mainly interested in the converts who, like Abner, for instance, wrote in Hebrew. So not Petrus Alfonsi, who wrote in Latin, or others. My sense is that there is something that connects between those converts who insisted in writing in Hebrew to address, you know, their former community on the one hand, and on the other hand, those texts are not accessible to their new community unless, you know, they are scholars and they know Hebrew, but there were not many of them knowing Hebrew. So I'm starting, I guess, pretty early with Yaakov ben Reuven. And I will touch upon Abner, but a little bit, because a lot has been done on Abner. Yehoshua Alorki, before he himself converted to Christianity. So before he converted, he was a defender of Judaism against his own teacher, Shmuel of Burgos. And I'm particularly interested in the last one from the 15th century, whose name is Moshe HaKohen. And the question is, what in the 15th century he could have innovate that was not that was not written or was not discussed before the 15th century, and apparently quite a lot from a theological point of view. So this is basically my next project.
I wish you the best of luck with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ari.
I'm extremely grateful for having had this time to talk with you today, and I'm blessed by the erudition that you shared. I loved reading this book, and I would absolutely recommend it to all our readers. I would absolutely recommend this book to students of Jewish thought and philosophy, students of philosophy in general, students interested in the hermeneutics of Jewish thought. And I would also encourage those interested in epistemology more broadly to engage with this book. I think it has tremendous wisdom to offer, and I'm humbled that I was able to talk to you today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. The pleasure is all mine.
Thank you. As we bring this interview to a close, I'm your host, Ari Barbalot, on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. Today, I have been talking to Racheli Haliva. She is a junior professor at the Institute for Jewish Philosophy and Religion and one of the co-directors of the Maimonides Center for Advanced Studies Jewish Skepticism at Universität Hamburg, University of Hamburg. We have been discussing her book, Isaac Pulkar, A Jewish Philosopher or a Philosopher and a Jew, Philosophy and Religion in Isaac Pulkar's Ezer Hadat and Teshuvat Apikorus, published in Berlin by De Gruyter in 2020. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.